The Baker Street Journal is a leading Sherlockian publication written by the readers for the readers. It contains both academic articles and light, fun reading for any sort of Sherlock Holmes enthusiast. If you are a fan of The Great Detective and the other works of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, and you'd like to read new and exciting writings by Sherlockians, or even find information on how to get published in the journal, please visit their website, www.bakerstreetjournal.com.
Wessex Press, an imprint of Gazadine Books, is a premier publisher of books about Sherlock Holmes and his world. They are also our publishers for The One Fixed Point in a Changing Age, A New Generation on Sherlock Holmes. It was edited by several of the Baker Street Babes and contains a foreword by Laurie R. King, the author of the Mary Russell series. Another brilliant book published with Gazadine Books is Matthias Boström and Matt Laffey's Sherlock Holmes and Conan Doyle in the Newspapers. If you'd like to know more about Wessex Press, Gazadine Books, or our publication, please go to www.wessexpress.com.
They call us the irregulars, but baby, we're always on time. Baker Street babes always leave the rest of them behind. So in Scotland Yard they send you home, you feel like you're losing your mind. If this quotidian world has got you crying, won't you 2-2-1 be mine?
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Baker Street Babes episode 74. Yeah!
Yay!
Woohoo! Sherlock Holmes, Behind the Canonical Screen. We are going to be talking about both the conference, which Ashley Poloshek and I attended, and the book. You'll be hearing from me, Lindsay Vay.
And me, Ashley.
And our friend Timothy Greer, who contributed the Granada Television element to the Behind the Canonical Screen anthology. You can find the Behind the Canonical Screen anthology at the Baker Street Journal's website. That is www.bakerstreetjournal.com. You can click under items for sale. bakerstreetjournal.com/behind screen will also get you there. Thank you so much, and enjoy the show.
All right, so we wanted in this podcast to talk about several different aspects. The first is we'd like to talk a little bit about the conference itself, because we didn't do that, and actually, way back when, that was in my pre-babe days, so I wasn't even on the
True
podcast
fact.
Then. And then we'd like to talk a little bit about the book itself, because Lindsay and I co-edited it, and we're really proud of that. And then we're going to do some bonus work talking about some things that could have gone in a similar book, but are not in this one, so it will be like a bonus audio appendix to the book.
Precisely, and Timothy is welcome to interject at any moment as a gentleman and a scholar who knows very much about this topic as well.
Well, what about this for a suggestion? I suppose maybe since the two of you are so closely connected with the conference, and I have more of the seat occupied by someone who wasn't there, since, you know, I wasn't there. What if I get to ask you some questions about the conference, and then maybe we move on from there to talking about the book, and then maybe a surprise bonus round at the end?
That sounds such a good idea.
We do that?
Let's do that.
And then we just kind of, you know, we'll keep it free form and flowing and expressionistic, but sort of, because I
What's
have
the soup du jour? The soup of the day. That sounds good.
That's
I'll
right.
Have that.
Right.
I'll
and
have
maybe
that.
It's one of those soup trios of which you are so fond. Yes. Now, so a little bit, first of all, about the conference, if you would. How did it come about? Who put it together? And what was its raison d'etre, if you will? Whoever would like to field this one. Tell us what this conference, Sherlock Holmes Behind the Canonical Screen, was in existence for to begin with.
I think, if I could speak to this.
Go for it.
It was the brainchild of Michael and Leslie, both of whom are gentlemen and both of whom are scholars. They decided that they wanted to, because they partly live in the area and have good contacts and have been BSI for a very long time, they would like to bring together a group of people who have been influential in the world of Sherlockian film, not just people who have commented on it, but people who have created it. So what they wanted to do was bring in people like Nicholas Meyer. They wanted to bring in the creators of The Great Mouse Detective. They wanted to bring in, at the time, this was a really big deal because Elementary hadn't been shown on the air yet. They brought in Rob Doherty. And he was so charming, and he talked about the first episode, which hadn't been aired. It was like the pilot, and we got to watch it. So it was basically something that was built in Los Angeles out of a love for both television, film, and Sherlock Holmes. And people really engaged with it. And I think that it actually is a giant kudos to these guys that they got such amazing guests because they really deserved to get that. And the Kegleys and the Curious Collectors definitely contributed to the evening as well because, well, the entire conference. They were absolutely instrumental in helping everything be facilitated. But the level of dialogue that was going on, it was awesome. And I couldn't have been happier to have been there.
Fantastic. Ashley, anything?
I agree with all of that. I really appreciate the people who put it together because it was really an event that ran very smoothly, and I've been to my share of conferences, and they don't always. I will say that for being involved personally with the conference, I heard about it the very first time I introduced myself to Les Klinger, which was the year before at the BSI weekend. And when he found out that I was studying Sherlock Holmes on screen, he mentioned that he was sort of in the planning phases of this conference and said that, I'm doing this conference, you should present a paper. And so that's how I ended up being involved with it. How did you end up being involved with it, Lindsay? I don't think I ever asked you.
Oh, I was asked to present something on Irene Adler because they said they needed a feminist panel. Mm. And then they said, can we put you with Ashley? And I was like, yes.
Yeah, let's do that. So
let's do that. That sounds fine.
The two young women ended up both presenting papers on women because somebody had to. And they put us back to back, and then we did our Q&A
together, which actually ended up working great. Yeah. And there was not a glitch in the world, and it was marvelous. I was approached as somebody who has been commenting on different incarnations of Sherlock Holmes for a while because, you know, I don't claim any sort of superiority in this field. But I have actually been reading the canon since I was 10, so that means 1990. I know that's really early, but I've not stopped reading it since. And it's always marvelous when people want you to talk about your impressions of the actual stories. So what I presented was Irene Adler as she exists in the canon, Irene Adler as she exists in the Warner Brothers films, and Irene Adler as she exists in the BBC Sherlock series. And I concluded, I think, pretty obviously by the end of it, that unfortunately, and I say unfortunately only because we're living through it, but the Arthur Conan Doyle version, probably the most feminist of all of them, and we may have slipped backward by accident.
Yeah, so. when you elevate Irene to a, like, a foil foe and she becomes a master criminal, then, well, you're going to pit her against Sherlock Holmes and he's your hero, so where does that lead you? Well, it means that she doesn't, in the story that you write, she doesn't end up getting the best of him, which is the sort of the whole point of her character. Which is to get the best of him.
Right. Which is like the entire point. So exactly, like the entire point. So there's something in storytelling that becomes very obvious when you start reading the Sherlock Holmes mysteries, which is that Sherlock Holmes wouldn't work if he had never been defeated. And I maintain this all the time, but it's true. Like, if he had never been defeated by anyone, then you wouldn't keep reading them. it would become boring. You would just figure, like, okay, Sherlock Holmes is going to win. But the very first case of all of them, he's beaten on his own playing field. He's beaten by a woman, hands down, and she is unapologetic and joyful about it because she's going off to marry the person she loves, and she's like, okay, so, well, you tried to thwart me, but I'm not thwarted.
I remain decidedly unthwarted.
I am so, unthwarted.
As tempting as it is to rehash our own papers,
I know.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the other wonderful people who are presenting. There was really...
Wait, you haven't talked about yours yet.
Essentially, I wrote a paper that fit into my overarching thesis in my work, which is examining the nature of the evolution of the Sherlock Holmes character over time, and using various adaptations as benchmarks for that. So in this paper, I specifically was looking at how women are portrayed with respect to Sherlock Holmes and his attitudes toward them and so forth, as kind of cultural touch points. So I compared the presentation of women and Holmes's relationships with the women in the stories from 1965's Study in Terror and 1979's Murder by Decree, both of which essentially have the same cast of ancillary characters because they're both Holmes v. Jack the Ripper stories. So you have this sort of ready-made set of characters, this ready-made, quite natural comparison to draw. And 1965, you know, right at the beginning of second wave feminism, 1979, fairly near the end of that that cultural movement. So it seemed like a kind of a natural thing to look at one and the other to see if we'd made any progress in the middle and how women were portrayed and how Holmes dealt with women, whether perhaps in moving from 1965 to 1979, Holmes himself had a kind of consciousness raising. So in some respects, yes, and in some respects, no, and certainly we still have a lot of work to do even now, but it was an interesting sort of case study to go with. So that's what that was.
And great. I wanted to mention to people who are out there listening, this may be, I may go a little bit outside the boundaries here. If I do, you can always edit me out. these presentations may be viewed online, these two. I won't mention the name of the website, but they are fabulous, and you should go and look them up and watch them many times and like them and share them.
The Q&A is the best part where we're like, trans
yes.
What?
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely the best part. But you get a lot of the flavor of the atmosphere of the room and who the people were at the conference, you know, not just presenters, but the audience too, and kind of the dynamic and the back and forth and all that. So it's a good addendum to the book. Maybe.
It also does provide you with a clear vision of just how giant and intimidating it is to have your PowerPoint presentation projected on a cinema screen behind you. Because I'm used to academic conferences where the majority of panels happen in classrooms. I've had them in some more interesting venues sometimes. I've had them, you know, Senate House in London, where I've basically delivered my paper from behind a court bench. But having it on a cinema screen is something else. It makes you much more meticulous when you put your PowerPoints together. I'll tell you that right now. Font choices become very important.
In VistaVision, camera 65, Ashley Palage.
Yeah. I love that you say that because I didn't give a shit, dude. It's so cool. Like, I was like, I have to do a PowerPoint. And they're like, yeah.
I remember emailing, what do I do?
Where do I find a program?
I remember the emails. How do I PowerPoint?
And then I'm like, screen capping things. And I'm like, this is a good screen cap. This is what I mean. I need this. And then I take it. And I, like, you know, turn it into a PowerPoint. And then I put a subtitle under it. And I, most of my presentation, I think, to be honest with you, is not best viewed in the book. It is best viewed on the interwebs in the YouTubes, because then you can see my PowerPoint subtitles. Like,
I think it's thing. Both. I think you want both. Let's get the full experience. You want to be able to read along and watch along, and it's just a lot of fun that way, in my opinion.
I put most of my PowerPoint pictures in the book. As long as I was going to control what went in the book, I did that for everybody. Anyone who submitted a PowerPoint to us with their paper, yeah. Just stole pictures out of their PowerPoint and put them in the book.
Ashley was...
With proper attribution, of course, but I also took some more screen grabs and took them off the internet, which is why the book is absolutely jam-packed with images, because I was like, well, never again will I ever get a publishing contract where they allow me to just have carte blanche putting whatever color images I want exactly in a book, right. So I'm going to have some of these and some of those and lots of this and a little of that. And so, like, there are chapters where there are, like, 13 images... 15 images, 11 images. Well, yes.
So now we would want to go into some of the other presentations at the conference, because here we have some name dropping.
Yes.
To do.
Yeah, we do.
I want to hear about some of this stuff.
Well, from three different realms, really.
Yes,
and,
correct.
And the Venn diagrams overlap, obviously, which is the joy of a conference like this. But if you think of your Venn diagram with your three circles, one of them is the Sherlockian circle, one of them is the academic circle, and one of them is the practitioner, professional circle. And those are kind of your three categories. And then you have people who cross over, like I'm an academic and a Sherlockian, and... You know,
that's why we broke up the book that way.
That's exactly, but we'll get to that. So if you talk about names in Sherlock Holmes, you know, if you're talking about people who are great Sherlockians, and you look at the program, you'll see people like Russ Merritt, who of course is wonderful expert on silent film as a scholar, and then is with Peter Blau. I think they are the longest invested BSI?
Longest toothed?
Right there. Also, of course, we had John Farrell, who has sadly since passed away, but John Farrell was a favorite. That was the only opportunity I ever had to meet him, because he didn't travel very much off the West Coast later in his life. So it was a joy to have him talk about Sherlockian musicals.
He's going to be very dear to our hearts and others too. Could you tell people listening a little bit about who John Farrell was and why he was so beloved to us, to the Kegleys, and a lot of people on the West Coast who were faithful readers of his?
I wish I knew more about him. He was a journalist who wrote a great deal.
Maybe. He was maybe the best theater critic on the West Coast, or certainly up there in the top. Theater, opera, and classical music critic for the Los Angeles News Group. And he was a larger-than-life character in real life. He dressed as a Victorian toff and went to the opera and so on. You know, very much our kind of Joe.
Yes.
Wore a top hat, carried a cane, and a silk hat, and all that stuff.
And also a snarky sense of humor, I understand.
Right.
He was invested as the Tiger of San Pedro, and he had a scion called the Tigers of San Pedro, who never held a meeting. And any time somebody accused him of having a meeting, since he was the only member, anytime he was anywhere, he could potentially be having a meeting, and he would always be careful to acknowledge that this was not to be considered a meeting of the Tigers of San Pedro. The conference, for the record, was not a meeting of the Tigers of San Pedro.
All right. Who else presented at the conference?
We had, Jerry Kegley presented.
Kegleys were instrumental, I think, in making the whole conference come together.
Absolutely.
At the end of the day.
Yep.
And it was marvelous that they did so, because it was not only an effort on the part of Michael Keane and Les Klinger and John Bergquist, but it was also the Curious Collectors are going to give you a layup into this basketball hoop.
Now we have to actually, you know, practically make a thing happen. And
exactly.
The Kegleys were there at the hotel checking people in. And
they were.
They're wonderful people. They're so friendly. And I'm always amazed that I was amazed at the time, not anymore, because I'm very close to them now. But at the time, I remember being amazed when I walked in that they recognized me immediately and knew my name. And that just made me feel so immensely welcome at this event, where at the time I really didn't know that many people in the Sherlockian, you know, face-to-face world. So that was really a pleasure. Jerry, I think, was sort of a last-minute addition to the program, but he presented quite well on Rathbone and Bruce, and lovingly.
Loving
tribute to wonderful films.
That's not a series of films that anybody should denigrate ever.
No.
Because it's so good. You know, at the end of the day, it's so good.
And certainly many academics, and perhaps we might talk about them a little bit more when we get into the book portion of it, because perhaps they shine with their with a lot of analysis that works better perhaps in written form than it does in speaking form, though their presentations were still commendable. But you may be interested in the slate of people who primarily fall into that third circle, that practitioner circle. In there we have some names that are fairly impressive. Of course, Nicholas Meyer was on a was doing a talk back with John Landis, famous film director, of course, and they talked about simply the process of adapting Holmes for screen. John Musker and Ron Clements, who basically are responsible for my childhood, because the first film I ever saw in the theater was The Little Mermaid. But they talked about The Great Mouse Detective, and it was a joy to see them. And of course, we had Rob Doherty as well, who screened the pilot of Elementary for us, which was pretty neat. It hadn't aired yet at the time of the conference, and then he was there to, I think, rather bravely face down a room full of Sherlockians and scholars who were ready to. As we know, there's a lot of love for Sherlockian film, but there's also a lot of vitriol with people who tend to be a little bit snobbish, or can be a little bit snobbish, and that's a kind interpretation or completely miserable about Sherlockian film. Not that I don't think this was a conference that most of them attended, because they probably looked at it and went, "Ugh." But actually, Nicholas Meyer has always said he has never met a Sherlock Holmes film he didn't hate. But Rob Doherty,
well, that's a good example.
Yeah, Rob Doherty was perhaps a bit naive with his audience. But
he was,
but brave nonetheless to face us all. So, and anyhow, he's the one with the hit show and not us. So whatever, his naivete obviously hasn't hurt him.
It was interesting though, because as he was presenting it, he was saying like, "Oh, did you notice the part about the bees?" And everyone in the audience was like,
"We got it."
But he was so kind about it.
Like, he was really, cute. Like, he really, really was excited that he'd planted Easter eggs.
Yeah.
And I think he was
perhaps... It was super nice.
Yeah.
And so everybody's like, yeah, we got the
bees.
Bee thing.
We're in there. Single stick? Yeah. We're with you. We're totally with you. Yeah. No problem.
And then we were like, what are you doing? I actually do like that show.
I do like the show too. I do. I think it's fun and entertaining. So there.
I thought it got immensely better about halfway through the first season.
Yes.
And I'm pretty much watching it faithfully ever since. I do enjoy it quite a bit.
Yeah. Once they found their own voice and they stopped trying to imitate procedurals of other stripes.
Other CBS shows.
Yeah. As soon as they kind of went, okay, well, this isn't just going to be another CBS show. This is going to be its own thing, and it's got to have its own voice. And they did that, and I think it's a fun show, and I really like it. And Lucy Liu is an awesome Watson.
She's so cool.
And anyone who disagrees can come find me and my sword. So there.
She's always great, and no surprise, she does a great job as Watson. And then I think the moment that turned it around for me on that series was you, me, baton, whap, that one. It comes up behind you like, okay, now that felt very Sherlockian. I'm totally down with that now.
I'm in
okay,
now.
So,
I'm in.
Yeah.
So
we did the Sherlockians who presented. We're going to do a little bit more about academics. We did some of the well-known professionals who presented. And according to the timer that I'm looking at here, we might move on now to the book.
The book.
How did the book come about? Because here, in my estimation, is how the book came about.
Go.
We weren't aware that we wanted to have a book, but then the conference was so good that it became obvious that we needed a book. But then the presenters had been scattered to the four winds, and there was no way to round them all up again and get all their stuff together to go into a book. What shall we do? I think they went out. The aforementioned Mike Whalen and Les Klinger and guys who put the conference together in the first place another great show of wisdom got a couple of gunslingers to go out, round all this up, and make it happen, that being you two. That's my understanding. You can correct me if I'm wrong, to turn this into a book by much labor.
Yeah.
So talk about the, if you will, the process of going from the aftermath of a conference to make it into this book.
Well, first of all, a lot of time went by because initially Les and Michael Keane, were going to edit the book, and they're just very busy men, and they
didn't. Les was busy freeing Sherlock.
Yeah, which, bless him, we needed that to happen. But it meant that in 2 years, people get new computers and like their documents get deleted and stuff, you know, and they didn't do, I mean, bless their hearts, but they didn't do a great job archiving the presentations, in print form. I sent mine and my PowerPoint to Les before the conference, but not everybody did that. And,
I didn't even, well, no, I did, but at the last minute,
but it existed.
Yeah.
Which is not the case for several of, what happened, well, from my end, I got an email that was already on a long chain of emails in which the very last one was, "Lindsay, we'd really like you to edit this book. Maybe, if you need some help, you could ask somebody who is also at the conference. Ashley Polasek, perhaps." And that was...
That's exactly what happened.
That's what happened. So, like, they'd had this big discussion. They probably looked at all the people who were on the list and were like, "Who could we get to do this thing?" And then they went, "Oh well, we'll get Lindsay to do it." And then Lindsay will obviously need help because it's too big of a job to do. And also, if we present what we actually have at the moment to Lindsay alone, she might go on a killing spree. So, and they felt perhaps that I could mitigate the
murder
genocide. That was sure to follow.
Again, that sounds like a solid plan from start to finish to me, right? They got it. Very well done.
Yeah.
Well, I hold the book here in my hand, and I'm going to say that the proof is in the pudding. So they were not wrong about your ability to make all those things happen, and also about the conference making an outstanding book, in my opinion. And I want to talk a little about the book. It's from BSI Press, and it's called Sherlock Holmes Behind the Canonical Screen, Papers from the Conference Held at the UCLA School of Theater, Film, and Television, August 31st to September 2nd, 2012. Edited and with an introduction by Lindsay Fay, ASH, BSI, and Ashley D. Palaszczuk, PhD, ASH, and even though it seems to not be on the cover here, BSB, BSB. This is the two-babe edition. Are there any other Baker Street babes involved in the making of this book?
No. Just the two of us for now.
Clearly, that was all we needed for an outstanding book that I am now thumbing through the pages of. So now we know a little bit about how the two of you got onto the project. What was your
my methods.
What was your rubric that you had set up so you could say, if the book turns out like this, it'll be good and we'll be happy?
They specifically asked us to produce a book that reflected as closely as possible the actual conference.
Yes.
So we set out to do that. There was nobody that presented who we edited out.
Right.
And there was only one paper in the book that we commissioned especially to go in the book to fill in what we felt was a real gap in the information presented. And you can speak to that later. But essentially what they wanted was a book that really was a record of the event, though we did encourage people to revise and edit their material. We certainly did a lot of work in kind of trying to get something that was cohesive and that...
And unfortunately, we every so often got people who said, "No, I actually, when I do this presentation... It is so graphic that in terms of like actual graphics, dresses, costumes, etc., there were people who said, "No, I can't write you an essay."
Yeah.
and we were declined a couple times.
Most people who participated in the conference were willing to do the legwork. However, there was a range of what we had to work with, and we essentially decided between the two of us that we would do whatever it took to meet that standard and to recreate the conference. And what that actually required, in some cases, people sent us pretty pristine essays, and they didn't require very much work at all. In some cases, people totally rewrote their papers and sent us things that were much longer than what we could manage, and so we had to do a lot of editing to get those things cut down. And in some cases, people spoke very nearly extemporaneously, and they either sent us very vague outlines of what they think they might have said, or they had nothing and said, if you want what I had to say, then there exists audio of the presentation, and if you transcribe it, you can include that with my approval. So, probably about 30,000 words of the book came from pure audio transcription, and then was then approved by the speakers. So that there was a lot of listening,
and that was 100% Ashley.
That was
Ashley transcribing.
My word!
I spent
that was her sitting down typing everything. Oosh.
Those were office hours that my students never came to. So we had a
deal with each other where we were like, I am going to do the things that you don't like to do, and you're going to do the things that I don't like to do.
Yep, it was marvelous, because I would rather spend 10 hours sitting on my own transcribing audio than to spend 10 minutes attempting to actually communicate with human beings. So my job was to transcribe the audio stuff that needed transcription.
And my job was to do wrangle
all the people. So she did all the communication with all of the contributors and tracked people down and double tracked people down and told them when their things needed work and all that kind of stuff, which I just all that stuff makes me shrivel up inside like a boiled shrimp. So
each to her own stronghold. That's
yes,
fantastic.
We made a very winning team is what
great.
I mean.
Absolutely right. I want to point this out too, along with what you're saying here. Here's a special sort of wrinkle in that whole process. In the case, for example, of John Farrell and his chapter Singing, Dancing, and the Sherlockian Musical, John had passed away in the interim between the conference and the book. So here you are working with notes, maybe audio, I don't know, but you don't have the ability to consult with the person who gave the presentation anymore. You have to do a faithful representation of what he did based on the evidence that you have and put together a paper that captures some of his style and spirit of presentation. It's wonderful. I finally got a chance to read it here just recently, and it's terrific.
That's one of those things where you just don't edit it.
Yeah, we had to make a decision, and we actually we communicated with Jerry Kegley, who knew John obviously much better than we did, and we said, look, we don't want to not include his work because we think that the more John Farrell in the world, the better. And frankly, it's a testament to him to have his words in this book, and we'd really like that. And if you think that that is the case, we're going to transcribe his presentation, essentially word for word, because it's witty and it has a lot of information and it's brilliant and people deserve to hear it. And we're going to send it to you for you to sign off on. And so Jerry Kegley was kind enough to kind of give vicarious permission for that material to appear in the book. And we appreciate that. So it essentially feels like an unfinished piece because it is. John was extremely brilliant and he spoke completely extemporaneously. There were no notes to work on. He just got up and spoke, I've never seen anything quite like it, because transcribing his presentation, which was completely off the cuff, was less work than editing some people who had written essays.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, this is a man whose extemporaneous speech was cleaner than most people's eighth draft. And it was very little work to actually transcribe, and it was a pleasure to do. But we were really glad that we could include that.
You're here. I know a great many of John's friends will be excited and pleased to see that chapter in the book, and they will love reading it. And some of his faithful readership over the years may be able to seek it out for that reason as well. if every chapter in the book is as faithful a representation of the talk from which it comes as the two done by the two of you, I've seen the video version of the presentation and now read both of the chapters, then you've produced, mission accomplished, you've produced an extremely faithful representation of the conference, because it sticks very clear. It gives us a great reflection of what the two of you did in your presentations, and I'm sure everyone else got the same treatment, if not even a little more careful handling. So well done, good on both of you.
Oh, thank you. I was particularly really thrilled to find that the people who are quite famous were really, really accessible. People like John Musker and Ron Clements, who, yes, quite frankly, have a lot better things to do, right, than talk to us, and who have a lot more important projects to do than put their work into this, spent the time to read over the transcripts of their talk and make individual edits. And that was really sweet. And they, you know, maintained proper correspondence with us and talked back and forth about things. And despite the fact that they originally identified you as a man, they were incredibly adorable, because as soon as you said, "Actually, I'm a woman," apparently they went and Googled you, and they were like, you're totally a woman and you're really pretty and I'm so sorry. And, please accept my firmest apologies. Mea culpa. And they were so cute. I just want to squish them both. So yeah, everybody was really, really
what, Musker and Clements? Yeah. I mean, like, yeah, no, they were great, but like, it doesn't matter that they made that mistake.
No,
like,
it doesn't. I mean, it was just adorable.
It was cute.
Their reaction to the correction was,
they were
not like,
oh, like, right, horrified.
As befits the guys who made the Great Mouse Detective.
Well, quite.
That's how they should have been. That's how they should have been.
Though, by the way, they would like you to know that it's not really the Great Mouse Detective. It's Basil of Baker Street, which you'll learn when you read their chapter. They don't call it the Great Mouse Detective.
They don't like that.
And they're pretty furious about other people calling it that, including
Disney. I love that. It's a much better title. Basil of Baker Street.
Yeah.
All right. So,
as based on the Eve Titus books.
Yes, as based
on the Eve absolutely Titus. Correct. Yes. In which the character Rusmer is Russell Merritt.
Oh my God! Really?
Bum bum bum!
Oh my God! I didn't.
True fact of truth.
See, not only are you going to learn things in the book, but you're learning things just on the podcast about
on the Baker Street Babes podcast.
Only so, here. Only
about
here.
The book.
Only here.
And by the way, I have a PhD in this, and I learned tons of things in people's,
right,
in people's work that I never knew, because I, you know, there are so many different aspects of Sherlock Holmes on screen that I've never taken the time or needed to go investigate in any detail. I mean, people talking about things like, you know, Sherlock Hound and just great stuff. Lots of stuff about silent films and early detective films. Wonderful, wonderful material. Certainly all the material about Great Mouse Detective was great. Mm-hmm. Material about all the little backstories that Nicholas Meyer and John Landis, like, while they were just shooting the shit. I included
that was
all
so cool
of that stuff in the transcript.
That is
I didn't cut any of it out.
I feel like their film students just need to get this book for that chapter, and also probably anyone who's into adaptation needs the chapter with Betsy Rosenblatt. And
absolutely.
Yeah.
Anything that anyone wants to mention about the book itself before we move on to things in the book but not in the conference and all kinds of tidbits and bonuses and wonderful things?
I will say one thing, which is if you are somebody who is a detail-oriented person, you will see that the original, I believe the original program and the article about the conference is reprinted as an appendix. And you'll see that it does not match the order of our chapters. And I just wanted to mention just very briefly why we decided to structure the book the way that we did. We put the book into three sections. The first section dealing with backgrounds. So chapters that deal with kind of whole genres of Sherlock Holmes. So like the detective film or Sherlock Holmes silent films or Sherlock Holmes musicals or Sherlock Holmes cartoons. The second section is all on specific case studies. Chapters, there's a chapter about adaptations of Valley of Fear, adaptations of Sign of Four, or there's a chapter on, you know, the Rathbone films. There's a chapter on the 21st century Sherlock Holmes. And then section three is all about practitioners. So you get things like restoring films, which is a very interesting section that has to do with finding rare films that need putting back together, which would make a nice companion piece to our other podcast that includes you.
Right.
And
then people are creating things.
Yes, and people are creating things. So we have the copyright intellectual property chapter in there, and Meyer and Landis and Musker and Clements and Rob Doherty in that section. They're organized like that so that the chapters actually kind of communicate something in conversation. So hopefully you can find that it works to just dip into a chapter, but it also works to kind of read it all the way through as a continuous narrative. And the very last thing I wanted to say is that Lindsay and I decided to dedicate the book to the late, great Sir Christopher Lee.
We did.
Because we could, and we miss him, and his fingerprints are all over Sherlock Holmes on screen. So,
God bless you, sir.
Yeah.
What a talent.
What a talent. We miss him.
I would also like to mention the cover for this book, which was designed by the Wessex Press, is a showstopper. It's got William Gillette on the cover, who you know we love. We saw his film in San Francisco.
Right.
And a great old reel of film, like out of an old-timey film canister. And all of the color scheme of it is terrific. It looks like sort of like a rampage of early three-strip Technicolor or something like that going on, and a good explanation on the back of what this book's all about. I love the cover of this thing. You know, it's not that you should judge a book by its cover, but this one's pretty cool.
Well, never judge a book by its cover, but it's not too shabby, right?
That's right. An ugly cover will drive them away like crazy.
This organizational structure, as we were putting it together, and I was putting together section two, case studies. We had two case studies that were specifically about Sherlock Holmes stories that had been adapted several times. And then we had several chapters that were about sort of flashpoints in Sherlockian film. So Basil Rathbone films are really important, obviously, and the 21st century Sherlockian sort of films. So you have Guy Ritchie and Moffat and Gatiss. Yep. And I looked at those two things and I went, hang on a sec, there is a really abominable gap here. And it's not the fault of the conference organizers, but you have to deal with the papers that get submitted to you. And as it happens, nobody submitted a paper to present on Jeremy Brett and the Granada series. And I said, Lindsay, I sent her an email and I said, Lindsay, here's the thing. The chapters that we have, everything is making a lot of sense, but there's this gap. Nobody did a paper or did a presentation on Granada, and we cannot publish this book and call it anything like a comprehensive assessment of Sherlock Holmes on screen if we don't have something about Jeremy Brett and Granada. And fortunately, you and I both know somebody who is eminently qualified to write a lovely, lovely chapter about Jeremy Brett and the Granada Sherlock Holmes. Enter Timothy Greer. So you, Tim, have the only chapter in the book that was not part of the original conference. You are the only special commissioned member of the team. So would you tell us?
So very proud to be here, I assure you.
We honestly couldn't do it without you.
No.
I think once again that just is another great sign of the wisdom and foresight shown by people who not only organized the conference but by the two of you in putting the book together, to know that simply could not be allowed to stand. We had to have something in there about it, because good grief, you can't really discuss other adaptations that have come along since then without running into that series on a regular basis.
I'm pretty sure I slid in a picture of you as cosplaying Jeremy Brett.
Not sure what you mean, but we'll go on.
I did that. That was me. Yippee! I made it.
Nailed it. Nailed it. So anyway, the actors from the show show up in Guy Ritchie's Sherlock Holmes films and other places, and then even in The Abominable Bride, you see so many things from the Jeremy Brett series showing up. You see deliberate homages to the props and different actors from different episodes of the Granada series, very, very specifically included in all the episodes. You can't get away from it because, it's great.
Okay, so I have a question to ask you, and I really want to specifically ask you this question. Are they homages to the props, or are they homages to the show, or are they homages to the actual stories? Because they're all based on the real tales. Right. So at a certain point, where do you draw the line between this was inspired by this adaptation or this was inspired by this canon?
Well, the like, Sliver reference. Theme song is pretty much definitely the show.
Right. That one's a hard one to miss. Is that a question to Ashley or me?
No, you.
Oh, okay. I think that there is an element of a judgment call there, of course, right? And it's almost kind of maybe that's on a case by case basis or something. But I have a twofold answer. If you think about the little, it's sort of a little Moroccan table. It's a octagonal table and sort of Moorish architecture style, and you see it on the set of almost every adaptation of Sherlock Holmes. There's one on the Granada set. There's one in the Baker Street sitting room in the Robert Downey Jr. Guy Ritchie films and Jude Law films. It shows up a lot, I think, because not that it really is mentioned in canon, but it shows up in this one illustration of Sidney Paget that is in the empty house when they make it. After the shooting of the wax dummy of Holmes, and they're back in Baker Street looking through my collection of M's is a fine one. And you can see it there in the foreground. And I think everyone just, it's cool, and it just shows up all the time. So maybe that's an homage to the stories, or at least to the Strand version of the stories. Everyone picks up on it and runs with it. You don't know who copied it from the Strand first, and maybe I think I'm copying it from the Granada series, but really they pulled it out of the Strand illustration. Meanwhile, I think some of the props, which are just, especially in the sense of, I don't know, you'll see Moriarty's pistol in the first Guy Ritchie film, the little four-barrel Sharps Derringer there's nothing inherently canonical, that comes out of his sleeve. There's nothing inherently canonical about that, but very Granada, because that's Wilson Kemp's pistol in The Greek Interpreter. And Mycroft takes it away from him on the train, and then it ends up being Sherlock's from then on. You see it in The Final Problem. And it shows up all through the rest of that season. And for it to show up again in another Sherlock adaptation,
Sherlock
I kind of...
Sherlock is not a good shot.
Right. And so Watson he's got a little last resort.
But Sherlock is like, oh, Jesus Christ. I have to fire this thing. Really?
Oh, where's my second?
Like, oh, for the love of mother.
I'm going to have one that only works if someone is actually on top of me.
Wrestling first we around. Enter into wrestling, then right. I shoot you.
Please don't fire. Okay. And then, I have blood on me.
Those are not easy to come by as antiques, and it seems like a very specific prop to try and track down when almost anything would do, unless you're just really deliberately trying to go all out Granada if you're the prop people for Guy Ritchie's film. So good for them. And there are a lot of others. I think it's possible to answer your question that we could identify it as specifically this seems to be an homage to the Granada series or to the Rathbone films or whatever, because it really doesn't appear in the canon. It's only there first versus right. Something where you could find it in the canon or in an illustration that originally accompanied the canon and go, I think everyone's kind of homaging Sidney Paget or Frederick Gore Steele maybe with this thing, but not with this other thing. And the theme music actually is a great example.
Right.
When you hear an obvious variation on that opening theme.
The opening shot there, the camera track down Baker Street in the first Robert Downey Jr. film does that too. In the same way that the Robert Downey Jr. film includes...
I love that you just called it the Robert Downey Jr. film.
In Plucking Strings Part 1, you have the Basil Rathbone homage, of course, to the plucking the strings and the flies and so forth.
Yes.
So sometimes it's possible to trace it, you're right. And all of these little gems, you've done such a wonderful job in your chapter. We knew that we got the right person before we even asked you to track down all these little gems. And your chapter really, it's almost an argument for why... your chapter needed to be included in the book in the first place is sort of how it reads. And I think that if people don't realize that your chapter was specially commissioned to fill this gap in the book, they almost lose something, because part of what you brought to the chapter and what you bring to the book is saying, this can't be forgotten. Look at all the tendrils. This is, Granada is the spider in the center of the web. Mm-hmm. Granada is the Moriarty, right? And if you can feel all of these little, the tugs and the pulls, and even if you don't see it, if it's not cited explicitly, if you can become familiar with this one program, you can see its influence stretching in all directions. And this is a good point, part of this to point out to all the people who may be listening who are more exclusively fans of BBC, which is perfectly fine. If that's all you like, that's all you like. But getting an understanding of the history of what Moffat and Gatiss knew coming into making the BBC show, which is Granada and Rathbone and the silent films and all the and Great Mouse Detective and all these other things that you may not personally be familiar with, this will give you such an insight into their approach to the show, which they've admitted is a kind of collage of all these other influences.
Hi, Jekyll.
That's Jekyll.
Hi, Jekyll.
Yeah. It was the voice print of a gigantic hound.
You know, if it wouldn't be a podcast that I was on unless Jekyll also interjected.
That makes me happy to hear the sound of your dog.
Yeah, well, his middle name is Baskerville, and he was born on 221, so I can justify putting it in here.
Well, I remember when the two of you called to bring this idea up, and I think the conversation went something like, we feel like this is not going to be a thing we want to do if it doesn't have something about the Granada series in it, and we were wondering if you would like to write it, and I think I said something like, I have to go, I have to write a chapter about the Granada series, but I click, you know.
As I recall, the return email had a Granada GIF in it.
Well, it was great fun to write, and one of the objectives was to try and point out the little, like as you say, little as many little nooks and crannies as we could that people might find interesting. There have been great things written about Jeremy Brett by David Stewart Davies and others who are mentioned in the article, Stephen Doyle and different ones in different books, and maybe a few things that we could point out that hopefully not all of them have been pointed out before. There are new nifties. There are some great images from the series included, a lot of them in color. That was very gratifying to see because I don't know, you turn the page and just bam, there it is. And you think, good grief.
They were going to put those things in color.
I know. It's just a twofold. This book nailed it. And that series either. Nailed it, you know? So, and the last thing, about it with me, I just want to mention this person's name, or a couple of names, was to point out this random idea that I feel like for an adaptation to really go into the realm of greatness, someone very much like a Sherlock Holmes has to be driving it, has to be behind it, who really has to know everything, has to be an extreme student of minutiae. And in the case of Granada, I really do think that was Michael Cox, the producer who wrote the Baker Street File, their reference book that they used on the set. Much like, we'll take Ashley, maybe one of your favorite adaptations. Much like I would say Burt Cools.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Is the Sherlock Holmes behind the BBC audio complete canon. And there, yes. So it was great fun to write and just pleasing to see in the book and finally get my hands on it. And I've been having a great time reading the rest of the book now, especially the chapters in the latter half, but because I had seen a little bit of the front half already. Mm. I had seen a little bit of John Farrell's and Jerry Kegley's, and those are fantastic. There's just so much good stuff in here. Kudos to you both. What else is going on in new and nifty bonus material that people might not know about accompanying this book? It seems like what's happened since this conference? There's been pretty much the entire series, Elementary.
Yeah, I mean, there are lots of things that could have gone into this book if people had written papers about them.
Ashley, please continue.
We hand it off, don't we, Lindsay?
There are a couple of things that have happened that are obviously quite important in the world of Sherlock Holmes on screen. The rediscovery of the Gillette film is a major one that happened since this conference.
we were lucky enough to be there, all three of us.
Refer to podcast episode 64 if you'd like to hear us, you know, blather on about that well.
And fairly and drunk. Squealing much feral
more,
pigs.
Much more freeform than that podcast.
We were a little bit drunker. And there was
a
little
time had by all on that.
Oh, so good. A couple other things have happened as well. Of course, as Lindsay said, almost the entirety of Elementary, right? In fact, the entirety of Elementary. So all that's happened there, several seasons of Sherlock, of course, though Sherlock is covered in this book in a small measure. Also, the reissuing of the British Film Institute's remastered version of the Douglas Wilmer BBC Sherlock series from 1964-65, which is a really wonderful series. The fact that the book doesn't cover some quite important Sherlocks, Peter Cushing, of course, also, like Christopher Lee, has his fingerprints all over Sherlock Holmes, and I would have liked to have seen him covered more, but...
Hear, hear.
You can, of course, find material on all of these folks scattered throughout other areas, and if you are interested in Peter Cushing or Christopher Lee, you can come talk to us, because buy me a drink and I'll talk to you for hours about both of them. What else do you think we've
We haven't talked about Matt Frewer yet.
Oh my god.
Oh right. There are those four fantastic. This book will make you feel pretty.
If this quotidian world has got you crying, won't you 2-1?